Deborah Prentice became the Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge in 2023. She's the first American to take on the role, and she's leading the university at a challenging time for higher education in the UK, with questions about funding, freedom of expression, student protest, striking academics, and even vice chancellor's pay, never far from the headlines. Before Cambridge, she was provost at Princeton University and a professor of psychology, where she focused on the social norms that govern human behaviour and the impact of unwritten rules and conventions. And before that, her first degree at Stanford was in biology and music. So, Deborah, we can expect some penetrating psychological insights into Beethoven, Bach and Mussorgsky. But you're going to begin with Ravel. Why this?
This is one of the pieces that I am a pianist, and this is one of the pieces that I played most recently. But it's also one that I appreciate enormously. I love Ravel. But this piece in particular, I love the reaching back to older forms, to Couperin, to older composers, and yet also the forward-looking elements, the style of it. You can hear some jazz, you can hear somehow the whole history of music in this perfectly formed piano suite. I love every single movement of it.
Yeah, it's the minuet from Le Tombeau de Couperin. And a tombeau in this sense means that it's a tribute, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a time, he wrote it between 1914 and 1917. It was a time of great collective loss, obviously during the war, and also of personal loss for him. He lost his mother at that time, and each of the different dances, really movements of the piece, is dedicated to a friend of his who died in the war. So there is a tombeau, a funereal feel to it, except not to the music. The music isn't at all mournful.
Thank you.
Lovely.
The minuet from Le Tombeau de Couperin by Ravel, performed by Stephen Osborne. Deborah, since you play that piece, I wonder whether you, when you hear a performance of something that you play yourself, you think, yes, I like the way he's done that, or I would do that differently.
Actually, I listen to it completely non-self-referentially. I try to just go with what they're doing. And actually, it helps if they've got a very different interpretation.
That was very poetic, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was very, very poetic. It was very well done.
Tell us a little bit about your early life, Deborah Prentice. You were born in Los Angeles. What was it like living there then?
I spent a very, very brief time in Los Angeles. My family is from the Bay Area, from Northern California. But in fact, I was born in L.A. while my parents were there briefly for, I think, a five-year period, during which my father, who was a musician, was writing music for television briefly. So that took us to Los Angeles. But in fact, he died shortly after that, and we moved back up to the Bay Area where we had family.
So you were largely raised by your mother?
That's correct.
Yeah. Did that have a great effect on you?
Sure, yes. I mean, only children of single parents, that's a very close bond. That's a very intense, I think, relationship that you have if you're the only child of a single mom. I had a very good relationship with my mom. She taught me a lot about music, among other things. But yes, that was, I think, very formative for me.
Very fascinating, because being a psychologist, you can look back a bit and see, what effect did that play on my life?
Yeah, I certainly can. My mum, who passed away in 2024, but who had a long, very long and very good life, she was very anti-psychology. She was not was not prepared to have me go there. So that was not a conversation we shared.
Yeah, but one that you did was love of music. And you learned the piano, didn't you?
I did. My mum, I think, was a musician who never had the opportunity to learn formally, but she sang. She loved to sing, so she always sang around the house. She would sing in church choirs, and there was always a lot of music in the house. So there was a piano in the house from left over from my father, actually. It was not a full 88 keys, but it was something to run one's fingers over. And from a very early age, I was climbing up onto the piano stool and playing. But my mother also, I was exposed to a lot of music through my mother. She always had records playing.
A lot of women of that generation were less able to realize their creative potential than their husbands, because they were busy doing what housewives were supposed, in quotes, to do.
Well, yes, and I think my mother, in addition, was the breadwinner for the family, so she was out earning a living and then coming home and taking care of the house. So she did not have time, and she loved literature, she loved music, she loved art, and we had, you know, original art on the walls, and we had music on the stereo, and that was very much a life that she felt she had not been able to lead.
But you began to be able to contribute to the household expenses, didn't you?
Yes. Turns out that if you start young enough, music can be lucrative, at least in small ways. So, yes, I definitely was out there earning a few extra dollars.
Accompanying church choirs.
That's right.
That's a very interesting thing to do at that age, because it gives you some sense of being an adult and having adult responsibilities before one is completely arrived at that point.
Yes, and I enjoyed that very much, actually. That was very important to my young life as a teenager in particular, that I could go out and I could earn money and I could dress the part and I could...
It gives you a degree of confidence.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. The next piece is a well-known classical work, but you perhaps remember it for balletic reasons?
I remember it as a child. I had a child's eye view. I went to see the Nutcracker. Again, my mum took me every Christmas to the San Francisco Ballet's production of the Nutcracker. It was probably the first classical music I heard live. But mostly what I remember it for is that it's the first music I think that I heard, you know, every year. And by the time I'd heard it for four or five years, I loved the piece. I loved the Waltz of the Snowflakes. And then I became very interested in how it worked, like how it produced the effect it did, because it's a great evocation of a blizzard. And I started listening for how the music did it, how it goes with the dance. I mean, it was my first moment of sort of listening to music analytically after having been swept away with, I mean, because it's, you know, the spectacle of it completely sweeps you away. But after you've seen it a few times, start saying, how does he produce that effect?
So as we listen to it, point out one little thing that you, for our listeners, can home in on that you were fascinated by.
I mean, listen to the compound meter and listen to the way that quickens. You know, you've got the evocation of the light snow at the beginning, and then listen to how the pace of the whole thing winds up. It's just brilliantly done.
Thank you.
One of the reasons Tchaikovsky is such a great composer for ballet is that there's such an ineluctable sense of movement, isn't there, in the music? It just drives you forward.
It does. It does. It's very distinctive. And trying to figure out what he does, how he produced that feeling, I think is
of course,
very compelling.
Yeah. Waltz time, 1-2-3, yes. 1-2-3, yes. Just does actually propel one slightly, doesn't it?
Yes, it's got that propulsive beginning theme.
We heard the Waltz of the Snowflakes from Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker, performed by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by John Lunchbury. Which subjects attracted you at school? Which ones did you enjoy working at?
Well, actually, I loved school. And I know that sounds very geeky and silly, but I always loved school. And I loved all subjects. I was especially good at maths and science. But I loved literature, too. I think, though, as a girl who was good at maths and science, that was interesting to people. So I was encouraged in that direction.
So perhaps not surprising that you went on to study biology at Stanford.
That's right. That's right. I really was very interested in systems. And I mean, I think there's a connection to the music as well, systems and how they work, right? And systems biology was really compelling to me.
I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because I often say to guests that it seems to me that there's a link between cell structure and cells in music, speaking as a composer. And sometimes they look at me slightly blankly, but you clearly rings a bell for
me. Oh,
you.
Yeah, definitely rings a bell. Well, people always want to equate music to maths, which, of course, that's a direct connection. But I think the systems biology is understanding the ways in which pieces fit together in a functional way. I think of systems as a garden, a fish tank. You could think about how the food cycle works within the fish tank, how the pollination system works within a garden, how the parts function together to create emergent properties of the whole, right? Which is very strong in music, I think.
You were able to keep up with your music because the American system is slightly different from the British system.
It is. And for me, the American system worked very well because I did not have a strong compass when I went. I was not from a university-going family, so I didn't know what I was doing, basically. So at Stanford, you could double major. I came in and started down the track of science, so that's chemistry and biology and physics and maths and so on. But in fact, I could take a large number of courses, your sampling, and I picked up music. So I had had piano lessons young and had not had lessons for a few years by the time I went to university. I had played a lot, earning money a lot and accompanied a lot, but I hadn't actually had lessons. I thought of music as something I was leaving behind when I went to university, and I was going to get serious and I was going to become a scientist or something like that. And then I discovered, actually, I gravitated back. So I started taking lessons in my second year and then decided I wanted to actually study it. I had always had an inclination toward music theory without knowing really clearly what it was. And I was able to pick it up in my second year and actually double major.
So what attracted you to the study of psychology then?
My biology background gave me exposure to a number of different social science disciplines as well. Developmental biology and developmental psychology kind of went together. And along the way, actually, I had a brief module on social psychology, and it resonated strongly to me. My other way in was actually through statistics. I had to take statistics as part of my biology major and turned out to really enjoy data and turned out to find that approach to understanding the human mind incredibly compelling. So found my way there.
Now, you could write a book as the answer to my next question.
I won't, I promise.
But as somebody who plays the piano and is interested in psychology, what does Beethoven represent to you?
Oh, perfection. Beethoven has been many things, actually. I was interested in Beethoven's kind of creativity, what he did to the forms. I've always been strongly interested in the relationship between form and production. The way Beethoven innovated on the sonata form, for example, and stretched out parts of it and contracted parts, I mean, that just fascinated me. So certainly that. Also, as a performer, the hurdles that Beethoven puts in front of a performer fascinated me as well. And the Waldstein, for sure. I had an excellent piano teacher who could explain to me how to approach it, how to play Beethoven, and it was just completely different from anything I'd done before. But there's also just the emotions he's able to get out of the music, the heroic. How do you make music heroic? There were spectacular things done before Beethoven, but the heroic ethos really was something that he managed, I think, to invent.
Which movement of the Waldstein have you chosen?
I mean, the first because it's clean and pure, I guess. And because there's a lot about the technique of playing it that I've learned lessons about life from. I learned a lot about myself and about performance and about behavior playing that first movement. The movement starts with two hands playing together, which is not an incredibly easy thing to do. It sounds like it would be very easy and you could tap your hands together very easily, but actually playing that way is difficult. And I remember saying to my teacher, how do I make my hands go together? And he said, you don't make your hands go together. He said, you just play and then you listen and you fix it if it's off, right? That actually, I've found myself giving people versions of that advice throughout my career. And every time I give that piece of advice, which is just do and then fix it, right? Don't try to engineer it. And every time I give somebody that advice, I think of the Waldstein.
Thank you. The first movement of Beethoven's Wallenstein Piano Sonata number 21 in C, performed by Igor Levit. You had talked about the advice you give to people. For you, did that represent getting to the top of the mountain and looking over, both musically and personally in a way?
At the time, it certainly did, yes. And that was my Everest for sure. And I wanted to play it, and I did, and I felt great about that. I think, like mountain climbing, maybe generally, then you look beyond and you see other challenges. So I think that was for my early life, the one I wanted to conquer. But then there were others after that.
And looking across the ensuing valley, you started teaching at Princeton in 1988. Mm-hmm. And was that where you started thinking about social norms?
It was. So I had done my postgraduate work at Yale, and there I did not think about social norms, actually. I thought about individual attitudes and opinions and beliefs. I came to Princeton, and Princeton was a very norm-driven place at that time, and I think still. It was a place of informal understandings of what we are and what we do. And it was a hard place to break into as a young person because nothing was written down. If you didn't know, then you didn't need to be told. And so it was a great place to study norms because, in fact, there were so many of them and so many bright students who wanted to study them too.
By that, do you mean that many people got their identity from being part of certain groups?
They did. They got their identity first and foremost from being a part of Princeton. And Princeton, compared to Cambridge, for example, Princeton is a much, you know, there are much higher barriers to entry, and it's much more of an internal world community unto itself. So a lot of people coming to Princeton was the most significant thing that they did in their lives. And then within Princeton, they would define themselves by membership in different kinds of groups. So your identity was, in some sense, which clubs, activities, you know, intellectual pursuits and so on you belong to, and all of those were governed by norms. So it was just a perfect, sorry to use the biology metaphor, petri dish for studying, studying norms.
What kind of conclusions did you come to about how it affected their behavior, their belonging to a certain group?
So the conventional way of thinking about groups was that they influenced you and you joined a group and then tuned your identity to what other people were going to think of you in that group. And so conformity, that idea that you're going to conform to group norms. And actually, if you see the way groups work, it's a much more fluid and organic groups and individuals co-create the norms that they live by. And those are not static. In fact, they work together in a system. And this is where the systems thinking comes from. That idea of identities and norms, the way individuals and groups make each other up. That was new when I was coming into the field in the 1990s. That was a new way of thinking.
You became well known for your studies on alcohol in this context. How did that come about?
So that actually came about through a student. One of my very first students at Princeton was the vice president of her eating club, which is the heart of social life at Princeton. And they were her observations about the ways in which people adhered to the norms of the quote-unquote drinking culture, heavy drinking culture, and yet each one of them experienced misgivings about it. So, you know, she said, well, yes, of course I party and I drink. I'm worried about how much people drink and how much even I drink, but nobody else is worried about it. They're all fine with it, right? And that disjunction between what you're doing and your experience, that disjunction between your behavior and your experience of your own behavior became the heart of a lot of what I ended up studying in psychology.
Is that a development of what was known as sort of pluralistic ignorance?
That's right. That's a way of describing the phenomenon where your behavior is being driven by your group self, but you've still got your individual self sort of reflecting on it and not entirely on board.
And were you able to use that knowledge, as it were, to help people?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the great things about understanding the phenomenon is that it opens up the possibility for change. Because, in fact, when a group has gone a little bit too far, if you will, in one direction, and the majority of people have misgivings about it, in fact, liberating people to reveal their misgivings is a way of getting the group back into line with where the individuals want to be. And that works in a lot of different domains. The drinking on campus domain was the first one that I worked with, but others have used that as well. You know, social anxiety, performance anxieties. Most students think that other students are having an easier time of it than they are. Certain kinds of emotions are difficult to observe in other people. So other people look more certain than you feel. Right? Of course, you look more certain than you feel too, but you don't realize that. So just as you project something that looks to everybody else, that makes everybody else feel insecure, their projections make you feel insecure.
The next music is by a composer who is wonderfully understated, Gabriel Fauré.
Yeah. And Fauré is the basis for so many interesting trends. He was so much ahead of his time. His songs are beautiful. I chose an early one, actually, partly because I accompanied a number of singers on Fauré songs, including this one. I accompanied my daughter on this one, so it has a particular resonance for me. But accompanying solo singers was always a very particular kind of playing for me. The beauty and the vulnerability of the human voice against a giant piano was always very striking to me. And getting the accompaniment to match the voice, to interact with the voice, was always something that took serious listening on my part. And foray was a particular kind of challenge in that way. The Au Bord de l'Eau, which is the song I chose, is one in which the piano and the voice, they're in conversation with each other. They're in dialogue with each other. And making that a conversation of equals, it was always what I would try to do performing it. And also you hear the beginnings of jazz, I mean, again, way ahead of his time, mid-19th century, but you can hear the 20th century in the playing.
There's a wonderfully sort of sinuous chromaticism there.
Yeah, isn't it?
And of course, you know, he was the precursor to Debussy and Ravel.
Yeah, absolutely. But you can really hear it in that one.
Yeah. Au Bord de l'Eau by Gabriel Fauré, performed by the soprano Barbara Hendricks and the pianist Michel D'Alberto. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge University, Deborah Prentice. Let's jump forward a little bit in time. You're married to a historian.
I am.
Jeremy Edelman.
Yes.
Where did you two meet?
We met in a lecture hall at Princeton University. We first met in a seminar, but the reason we ended up picking up an acquaintance, I think, was because we taught back to back in a lecture hall. So for an entire 4 months or so, I would be leaving and he would be entering at the same time. And, you know, we'd sort of...
Very frustrating.
Yes, exactly. But it gave plenty of opportunities to strike.
You have three musical children.
We do.
And spent some time living in France when they were young.
Yes.
So you had experience of the French system as well as the American and now the British.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I told my kids when we went to France that this was a free year. You know, we were going to a different country, different norms. So just go with it and don't worry about it, because whatever happens, you'll learn a lot of French, you'll get better at some things, and you'll go back to the United States and you'll be cool, right? So, of course, they did go into the French system. The American system is much more self-esteem boosting than the French system. In the French system, you get 13 out of 20 on almost everything you do always. You know, in the French system, pas mal is a compliment. And music, I mean, if you're playing it wrong, you're playing it wrong, right? And they're going to tell you. They're not going to sit while you play badly through something and then say, well, you might do a little more of this. No, they're going to, you know, tell you what you're doing wrong. And my kids were young, but the two boys who were then 12 and 9 were taking violin lessons. And they had a wonderful teacher who I would sit outside their lesson and she yelled at them in French the entire time. I mean, it was just, you know, and they would come out and I would say, you know, how's it going? Anyway, they loved her. They loved her passion for the music, and kids can adapt. And in fact, they can really benefit from that kind of novel experience.
Did this family interest in music lead you to this next piece where we've got two brothers playing the violin?
Yes. And so my boys played this. This was their Mount Everest when they were teenagers, and they played this together. And I did not know the piece, so they introduced it to me, and it completely captivated my imagination, partly because it is a very compelling, I mean, it's just an incredibly interesting sounding piece, especially the first movement of it is just got in my ear, and I heard it so many times, of course, with their playing it, that it captured my imagination, but also because Prokofiev wrote it to see if he could do it. And I've always appreciated extremes, right? This is just two violins, that's it. How interesting could you make it, right? And how long could you, in fact, draw it out? And I think it's a brilliant piece in that way. And it's naked, I mean, you can really hear it. And you notice in a lot of the music that I like music that challenges the ear. And I appreciate music where you can hear the lines, I mean, the contrapuntal. But counterpoint in Prokofiev's hands, of course, is a very different thing than in Bach's.
Well, let's hear Jaakko and Pekka Kuusisto in this first movement of the Prokofiev. There's something very beautiful about the intertwining of the two voices.
Yeah, that's what I would say too, yeah. That's not quite what C major usually sounds like, but it's great.
The first movement of Prokofiev's Sonata for Two Violins in C major, performed by Jaakko and Pekka Kuusisto. You did a study, Deborah Prentice, in which you asked students about gender stereotypes at Princeton. I wonder what that led you to discover.
Yes, I was interested in the persistence of gender stereotypes, but I was also interested in getting a slightly more nuanced view of them, because while I think there are elements of traditional gender stereotypes that have persisted, there's also been a lot of change. So I did a study again with a student, and a lot of what has motivated my work over the years has been the interests of students. But we wanted to see the ways in which stereotypes had changed and persisted. And what was interesting about it was that, in fact, while the women were allowed to do everything that men were they weren't held to the same standards as men were in many domains. For women, there was, this is a term that a former U.S. president a long time ago talked about, the soft bigotry of low expectations. Not as much was expected of women as men, even though they were allowed to excel if they wanted to. And that quality of gender stereotypes, I think, which this was work done in the early 2000s, trying to capture that was something new.
But presumably people like yourself have begun to change that.
I mean, what I would say is gender stereotypes, certainly stereotypical expectations, haven't for me, as I said, when I was young and I was a math kid, that was fine. People actually found that sort of interesting that I was good at maths. So I haven't been held back by traditional gender stereotypes. That said, I don't think anybody thought it was very important what I did. And while I think that's freeing, it may not enable people to realize their full potential.
I like the title of the paper you wrote, What Women and Men Should Be, Shouldn't Be, Are Allowed to Be, and Don't Have to Be.
That's right. That's right. Well, because that's the form that societal expectations actually take, right? And it's not just one thing. It's many things.
And do you think they still perpetuate the status quo?
You know, I don't know. And it would be interesting to know that now, to redo that, because I think that may have changed quite substantially now. A lot of things have changed. I mean, you know, for example, girls do much better in school than boys do in all subjects in earlier grades. And that's new. So now the conversation is really about how the school setting and the way that schools work might in fact be better suited to girls' qualities than boys. So the conversation is certainly different.
In 2008, you made some interesting comments about the campaign between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton to win the presidential nomination for the Democrats. You said that Hillary was in an almost impossible position. Why was that?
Well, I mean, Hillary was a good example of, you know, if you don't violate the stereotypes, you lose. And if you do violate the stereotypes, you lose. You can lose by violating the stereotypes, or you can lose by not fitting the image of a leader. And either way, that's a no-win.
So in other words, society doesn't or didn't like the idea of a self-promoting woman.
Correct.
But in order to become president of the U.S.,
you have to self-promote. Correct, exactly. And that, I think that bind is, well, there still hasn't been a female American president, and there still hasn't been a female leader in that kind of a political system.
Opera next.
Opera, yes. This is my earliest musical memory, I think, which is the Boris Godunov, the coronation scene from Boris Godunov. It's opera by Modest Mussorgsky, and very much, I think, ahead of its time. It's criticized. It's not a perfect work, I think, but it was about the life and reign of the Tsar, Boris Godunov. This was what my mom played around the house on her stereo. She loved opera. My mom's taste in music was different from mine. She loved the grand, and she loved...
This is about as grand as it gets.
Yeah, she loved opera. She had very defined tastes, you know, Italian opera, German opera, but this was her favorite opera, Boris Godunov, and it's very Russian, but it's very much in keeping with a lot of the literary trends of that time. It's quite intrapsychic as well as being triumphalist, and actually the coronation scene, I feel, captures both elements of it.
Thank you.
The coronation scene from Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov, performed by the bass Nikolai Giaurov, the Sofia Radio Chorus Choir, the Vienna Boys Choir, the Vienna State Opera Chorus, and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, all conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Do you like the sort of majesty of the music?
I do, actually. Well, it doesn't capture my ear as much. It captures my spirit. I feel that way every time I see an opera or, you know, a grand symphony, just the astonishing human achievement that is these great works, right? There's something just completely inspiring about it.
Deborah Prentice, you remained at Princeton for 30 years, becoming Dean of the Department of Psychology and then Provost in 2017. So obviously you were familiar with and became interested in leadership. Was psychology a useful area to have studied from that point of view, to understand motivation?
Yes, it's what I have, right? Mm. But I think that leadership is so critically about being the right person for this organization at this time. I mean, it's so critically about this relationship between the individual and the group. And motivation is key to leading a university because, in fact, it's not about telling people what to do. It's about enabling them to do. And it's about being able to motivate people them and give them the platform that they need to succeed. And where them is just an extraordinary range of people. It's the students, it's the staff, it's everybody, right? So yes, I find my psychology background to be perfect training.
So what made you want to apply to Cambridge University?
I'd sort of played every part in the drama of Princeton. And so there were no more mysteries left. And it was a moment in my life. My kids were growing up. My youngest was about to go off to university. And so I had a moment where I, you know, could either pick out my headstone in the Princeton cemetery or I could make a break for it. And Cambridge called. And I thought, well, University of Cambridge is probably not going to hire its first American vice chancellor, but it'll be really interesting. I'll learn a lot and I'll go on this ride. So I started down the path, not quite knowing what I was getting into. And by the time I got to the final interview, I really wanted the job.
I can imagine that given your experiences and what you could bring, and a slightly different slant, having been through the American system, I can imagine that those interviewing you were excited about a rather fresh outlook that you might bring.
Yes, and that was clearly what Cambridge decided that it needed at this time, was somebody who would see something different in it. I think they hired me because they liked the Cambridge that I saw and the skills that I could bring to bear on it. It's the reach, right? It's the reach back in time and the reach forward in time that I think is so compelling about the place.
We've been talking about how people feel they have to conform to conventions. How easy is it for university professors to be authentic in public life?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that university professors, for the most part, choose their profession to be authentic. Now, they become part of a system too, parts of their disciplines, parts of their fields. I mean, nobody is free. But I think that certainly university professors, you know, value that more than most.
Universities are a place where people can debate ideas without fear of being censored, but that's become a particularly tricky question at the moment. I mean, how does Cambridge ensure that freedom of speech is maintained?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the most important thing to realize about freedom of speech is that it's a principle we live by and it is something that we strive for every day. But it's not easy to really make people feel free. And it's not easy, not because of formal strictures, but because there are other people around who might have views on what you say. And it's hard not to be influenced by that, right? So creating a climate, a culture, and a context in which people truly feel free to say anything, to speak their mind, to express their opinions, is something to work on every day.
I think if all students had an opportunity to play in a string quartet, they would understand the whole idea of listening.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's one of the things that I always want to say about free speech is, you know, listening is an important component of it, right? And learning to listen openly and freely, and to be interested in what you hear, even if you completely disagree with it, is also an important skill as well.
And it's a Beethoven string quartet we're coming to now.
It is, and one that requires close listening.
Why?
Why this one? Oh, I mean, it's just the most spectacular piece of music ever, I think. I mean, you know, and obviously I'm not the only person who thinks that.
Beethoven thought this is
thought
one
this
of his
one was a really good one. It is, but I think this is one where I listened to it often. I listened to the late ones often, and it was a tough choice, you know, among the late ones. But I've chosen the first movement of the string quartet in C sharp minor. This one actually, I think, is particularly meaningful for me. And this is one where it's difficult to put into words what it makes you feel. I find it to be a completely immersive experience of listening and feeling. The feelings don't fall into, I can't say it makes me happy or it makes me, it'd be very difficult to put a label on the feeling.
It's the first movement of the string quartet in C-sharp minor, and perhaps since you found it impossible to put this in words, we should let Schubert put it into words, because shortly before his death, he said, hearing this, after this, what is there left for us to write? The Adagio, the first movement from Beethoven's string quartet in C sharp minor, performed by Quatuor Eben. Deborah Prentice, I was thinking of something you said about following a line as I was listening to that. And one of the things that struck me was I was following a line, and I suddenly thought, knowing where it should go, because he's already stated it, how is he going to get there, given the harmony we're listening to? And then somehow, miraculously...
He gets there.
He changes the harmony in a way totally unexpected.
Yeah.
That's kind of vision, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. You hear that in Bach, too, right? Mm. I mean, that's the beauty of Bach. Somehow, it's like magic, right?
You've been doing tours of state schools in the UK lately. Why is that important for you?
It's important for me to understand the education system here and where Cambridge is drawing its students. We no longer track our state school percentage, but it's, you know, something 70% of students come from state schools. And I've learned an awful lot from going out and seeing some of those schools.
How did you find the state of music and art in state schools?
Varied, actually. And, you know, it's difficult, I think. It would be the same in the US, actually, that it would vary a lot.
Should it be on the curriculum?
Look, I think making sure that students somehow have a way to play is critical. I was very lucky. I was state school educated, and I happened to luck into some piano lessons early on, and my state school provided me with some lessons in violin and cello and things that actually rounded me out a bit. But I think that giving all kids an opportunity to make music is extremely important. And whether that's through school curricula, if they can manage it, or through other kinds of organizations that supplement that, I think it's very important.
Because otherwise it will remain the preserve of the privileged and the well-off.
Absolutely. And it shouldn't do. Because, I mean, you have some incredibly talented young musicians from less advantaged backgrounds.
At the start of the programme, I mentioned some of the challenges facing universities. What for you is the most difficult one to overcome?
Gosh, you know, we're very, very fortunate at Cambridge right now. I mean, the sector has financial challenges, and we do too, but nothing existential, nothing that will prevent us. What I would say, I think, generally is the financial challenges of the sector mean that fewer and fewer universities are able to offer a full range of subjects for students, full range of courses. I think courses closing, those kinds of reductions in what is available, I think that's probably the biggest crisis facing the sector right now. I worry about a contraction of the sector that doesn't map onto what the country wants and needs, right? And I worry about a lot of universities needing to make very difficult decisions to solve their own problems, and the collective being worse off as a result of the decisions that they are forced to make.
Now, this is an awkward question for you to answer, but I have to ask it. At a time of smaller and smaller funding for universities, how can you justify what people like you are paid?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that so whether vice chancellors are paid too much or too little is a matter for somebody to decide. I mean, it's not a matter. I don't set my own salary. And whether I'm overpaid or underpaid, I'm very well paid and I try to work very, very hard for it. And that's all I can say.
I'm sure you do. Let's hear your final choice of music. Great. What is it going to be? You mentioned Bach just now, so I suspect we've not had him yet.
I know, and that's almost a crime that I've left him for last, because he's one of my all-time favorites, and playing the Goldberg Variations is my most common right now. That's my therapy, is playing the Goldberg Variations. But I've now come to Cambridge, and I've entered the world of great choirs. I mean, choral music at Cambridge is just spectacular. And actually, I didn't know the choral repertoire all that well, so I've been enjoying learning it. I actually heard a combination of some of the Cambridge choirs do Missa Solemnis recently. Really, really lovely. I didn't know that piece. I'd never heard it. But what I chose here is from St. John's Passion, which I was fortunate enough to hear at St. John's College, played on original instruments, just actually by a cross-section of students at Cambridge. And I have to say, you know, we sat in the chapel at St. John's and listened to St. John's Passion, and it rivaled the great sort of musical experiences I've had. I mean, it was just unbelievably great. So that was why I chose this.
Is there a particular moment you'd like?
The moment that I chose is one of the ones that from that performance was especially meaningful for me. But what I would say is the original instruments, and again, the rigors of performing on original instruments, the passion comes through. That's what I would say about it, is really feel the passion.
It's even greater clarity, isn't there?
Yeah,
so you
absolutely
can hear those lines you've talked about.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Deborah Prentice, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.